Welcome to the conversation.org, making sense of these times web radio program.
Could it be? Yes, it could. Something's coming, something good. If I can wait, something's coming. I don't know what it is, but it is gonna be great. With a click.
You're listening to our series of Suzanne's readings from Brian Swim's The Universe is a Green Dragon. We would love to hear from you. Email us at suzanne@mightycompanions.org. And now, here she is, Suzanne Taylor.
Well, here we are for the last episode of The Universe is a Green Dragon, the story of how we humans fit into this cosmic process, where we come to understand that our life is a sacred expression of this incredibly sacred universe. Here we are at the edge of it all, the latest invention of the universe, and here to understand, the only species that can understand what's going on. And of course, Brian Swim is our master revealer of just what that might be in the new story that we could be telling, where we really appreciate and exalt in this privilege we have of being human, where the development of the Earth is actually waiting on us. We're the hot thing that can take it further. So, just to recap a bit, this is the story of the universe having a beginning, where it evolved out of nothing. And why that's important is that we will find ourselves now in the same story. We're in a moving story, so we can think as one. Of course, oneness is what we have to appreciate in this upcoming phase of human development, or else, big trouble ahead. And Brian has infused in us this fundamental attitudes of gratitude and awe, whereby we really can take this journey together, where we can find ourselves in something really wonderful rather than something destructive and dangerous. So he tells us that there's a switch going on, a big switch, as we move from the old story to the new story, which is from a human-centered world to a cosmic-centered world. Humans are not the be-all and the end-all. We're just the edge of this much larger process, whereby awe would be our natural condition if we really were aware of the bigger envelope in which we find ourselves. And when we see the beauty of it all, well, of course there's some struggle to being human. A world in which pain and death exist is a world in which we have to really come to terms and understand how to maneuver. But seeing the vastness and the beauty of it makes the struggle worthwhile. And where do we start in all of this, following Brian's instructions? Remember beauty and awe. Remember the stupendous achievement of our unfolding universe. And once we open our eyes and see the larger picture, we can't contract into these little mean creatures. And then Brian tells us to live as alluring and remembering activity, as shimmering sensitivity. All of these are the ways he developed his story as we come to understand the great cosmic forces surging through us, as us. And here we are, creatures who are free. The creation of life forms is not determined, but is the outcome of life's intrinsic freedom, says Brian, whereby play and risk and surprise are the dynamics with which we are working, quite unique to the human. The human has the ability to play throughout life, exploration, surprising discoveries, experimentation, learning. These are things only humans are capable of, which gives us this wonderful capacity to be an original force in the universe. He says, for so long we've considered the Earth as just a big dead ball of dirt. We're involved within something that moves, however, and not just around the sun. It's not that kind of movement. It's not just we've discovered the movement of the planets, but that the whole process is alive. The universe is creating itself, and here we are on the edge of that creation, with the capacity to actually be a creative force, Hot times for this planet. We are here with beings' innate urgency to unfold. That primal fireball, that big bang, kicked us into this force of explosive creativity. And it's still here, and it's us. In many ways, Europe seems the victor. But throughout the last 200 years, the victors have been inevitably haunted by the presence of the Native American spirit. The Europeans suspected that the native creation-centered spiritualities were necessary for true health, but only the most gifted individuals articulated this awareness. A collision that could have worked out in psychic and spiritual space was projected out. So much of our destruction of the continent intertwines with our debilitation of women, Native Americans, and Black Americans. Dawning in our awareness in our own decades is the recognition that the complementary interaction between these two traditions is our most significant source of social creativity and political power. Now here, this is an important point, Suzanne. This is kind of the it of it. We enter a period of enormous promise. The scientific, technical, and that's hyphenated, the scientific, technical, Christian, masculine, individualistic, Northern European spirit joins with the ecological, animistic, feminine, communal native spiritualities in the creation of a new form of society whose significance towers over that of all other political or social events. Please God, says Suzanne. This is the cusp that we're on and the movement that we're making, and it's not a done deal. Back to Thomas. The psychic interaction that has been proceeding in a lopsided, destructive, and unconscious fashion for 5 centuries has entered a new phase with the rise of the ecological, women's, Black, and Indian movements. These transformations of consciousness reestablish the balance of our psychic centers of gravity, making possible the deepest reconstruction of contemporary society. Out of the creative energy welling up from the diversity of traditions, we fashion a form of society that takes us out of a global reign of terror and into a renewed health, into a new quality of prosperity, and into a more basic delight in being human in the midst of all the life communities. Oh, doesn't Brian say this beautifully? Don't you just feel this surging in you? This is what we're all chasing. Everyone who'd be even interested in listening to me and reading Brian Swim would be so empathetic with this and so passionately desirous that these changes and reworkings become who we are. Back to Thomas. We reinvent the human society by transforming our codings. This resembles the way the ecosystem rewrites its own genetic codes to transform its societies. Our codes are transgenetic. Our law codes, for instance, our legal system carries on processes formerly encoded genetically in the pre-human world. Our law codes will continue to reflect this work of societal transformation, as will our education codes and processes. Traditional customs involving foods, work, and play will all bear the effects of the changes. Our fundamental values and programs will be altered, and individuals and character types considered marginal during the past 2 centuries, that's us, will find themselves selected by society for political power. They will be chosen where before they were passed over, because they will increasingly represent the central convictions of American citizens. Oh, don't you just pray for this, says Suzanne. And you says, you speak with such confidence. Are you utterly convinced this will happen? Thomas, suppose you were there when the European plate began pressing against the North American plate. These two stupendous realities began to collide with enough momentum to continue buckling the land for another 100 million years. How difficult would it have been then to have had confidence in the appearance of mountains and in the transformations of all the societies involved. Youth. But that involves something you can see. The Earth's movement and all, Thomas interrupts. The heat in the core of the Earth and the pressure of gravitational interaction driving the collision, yes, they enable us to see the inevitability. There is a related situation in the human world, an irrepressible emergence of human energy. I'm speaking of the energy evoked by the story of the cosmos, by the story of the galaxies and stars, the story of life and Earth. If the collision of tectonic plates gives rise to earthquakes, the emergence of the cosmic story gives rise to human quakes. So, says Suzanne, this is why we read Brian Swim, to infuse ourselves with this energetic where we really can see, feel, taste, know that this story of the unfolding of the beauty of it all that we are carrying forth actually is the way it is. Brian Swim is the master at letting us, quote-unquote, see. So back to Thomas. Think of it. For the first time in human history, we have in common an origin story of the universe that already captivates minds on every continent of our planet. No matter what racial, religious, cultural, or national background, humans now have a unifying language out of which we can begin to organize ourselves for the first time on the level of species. All societies throughout human history have rooted themselves in fundamental stories of the cosmos. Out of their primal stories, humans define what is real and what is valuable, what is beautiful, what is worthwhile, what to be avoided, what to be pursued. Modern society is no different. We too use our basic cosmology to assign power positions, making all crucial life decisions on the basis of these fundamental worldviews. We are now restructuring our fundamental vision of the world. We are creating a new meaning for what we consider real, valuable, to be avoided, or pursued. The new cosmic story emerging into human awareness overwhelms all previous conceptions of the universe for the simple reason that it draws them all into its comprehensive fullness. And most amazing of all is the way in which this story, though it comes from the empirical scientific tradition, corroborates in profound and surprising ways the ecological vision of the Earth celebrated in every traditional native spirituality of every continent. Who can learn what this means and remain calm? Well, this is the end of that section, where Brian is presenting his case. He's taking his wrap-up of all that he's given us and shown us that here we go into the new, and it's us who are responsible. And this very last little section is called The Art of Forging Cosmic Fire. Youth. Wait a minute, I'm about to fall apart. Just, what are we doing here? We're just talking, right? Thomas. We're just talking. Youth. Well, how does it fit into everything else that's happening? Thomas. We're just sitting here talking. The sun is over China. The red oak is, youth interrupts. Right, but what does it mean to talk? What does it really mean? Thomas, to understand human language, we need to place ourselves within the context of Earth as a self-organizing reality. The Earth taught itself how to create the photosynthetic processes, how to bloom forth with the power of the angiosperms, how to create topsoil. Earth did not learn these things from Mars or the Andromeda Galaxy. Earth education is self-education. Humans are engaged in the same dynamic of self-educating reality. So here we sit, talking, a further development of the ancient Earth activity of education. Our situation involves something new, self-reflection. manifested especially through language. But language itself is just a part of a larger teaching process. We sit, talking, engaged in the education process of the earth. Is that clear? Youth. Okay. Thomas. At the present moment, the earth struggles to teach itself how to become more fully self-reflexive. Now, carrying on activities through self-reflexive awareness that previously functioned without this quality. Youth. But how does the earth educate itself? Thomas. Even as we speak, all of this is the earth educating itself. Think of the language that has come alive in just this one afternoon. Do you think we are solely responsible for that? Good heavens, no. Think of the sacrifices required of billions of creatures to make such language possible. Take a single sentence. The fireball exploded 20 billion years ago at the beginning of time. That sentence requires nothing less than the full 20 billion years of cosmic development. It is not my sentence, nor does it belong to the theoretical scientists who first predicted the existence of the fireball, nor the experimental scientists who first detected its heat. It is a sentence of the whole earth. Nothing less than that is required for its speaking forth. The sentence could not exist without the oceans, the rivers, the air, the life forms, and all the thousands of years of human cultural activities. Every sentence is spoken by the whole earth. All language is spoken by the earth as part of a biospiritual embryogenesis. You have been sitting here listening while the earth did the talking. Language belongs to earth as simply as the Cascade Mountains belong to earth. As earth struggles to enter self-reflection, you struggle to become the heart and mind of the earth, and so earth, including you and me, proceeds with its self-education. Youth. Before this awareness slips away, tell me about words. What happens with words? Thomas. As you listen to this language, which is Earth's language, you become shaped by words. Your attention forms within words. Your desires are shaped by words. Your visions of the future are ignited by words. In all of this, the universe shapes you, shapes itself through you, so that it might become more intensely present to itself through the unfurling of self-reflexive awareness. Isn't that beautiful, says Suzanne? This is all about becoming more intensely present to itself, the universe, us, everything, so that everything comes more alive. That's us becoming more alive, just what we're all seeking. In this deadening sadness of egos and superficiality, which is this beautiful sentence that Brian wrote to me once. Suzanne, we are pointed at the same thing, to ignite a great, raging forest fire of love, to sweep us forever out of this deadening sadness of egos and superficiality. That's why Brian writes, that's why I read you this. Thomas goes on. Our primary teacher is the universe. The universe evokes our being, supplies us with creative energy, insists on a reverent attitude toward everything, and liberates us from our puny self-definition. The universe gives us fire and teaches us its use. Youth. When you say gives us fire, you mean in the sense that, Thomas interrupts, I mean in the most immediate and simple sense. The universe gives fire, real fire, the fire of the heavens. Youth, how? Thomas, let's start with your present moment of experience. This involves sensations, thoughts, feelings, expectations, and hopes, the whole subjectivity that defines your now. We think of this as the psychic manifestation of bodies, neurophysiological processes. Electricity flows through your nervous system in physical correlation to your subjective experiences. Do you follow that? Youth. Sure, Thomas. So from a physical point of view, the movement of ions in your brain corresponds to your subjective experience. different ion flows would give you qualitatively different experiences, or, equally true, a qualitatively different mood would manifest as a different movement of ions in your nervous system. The question I want to ask is simply this: what enables the ions to move? Or what enables you to think? Or what power do you rely for your thinking, feeling, and wondering? Ions don't move by their own power. They have to be pushed and tugged about. A close examination shows that an energy-soaked molecule in the brain is responsible for the ion movement. Closer examination shows that this molecule is able to push ions around because of energy it got, ultimately, from the food that you eat. The food got the energy from the sun. Food traps a photon in the net of its molecular webbing, and this photonic energy pushes and pulls the ions in your brain, making possible your present moment of amazing human subjectivity. Right now, this moment, ions are flowing this way and that because of the manner in which you have organized energy from the sun. Oh, I just love this. Here we are, you know, just sitting around, listening, reading. And look, he's hooked us up with the entire cosmic process, dear Ryan has. And you can feel it. You can just feel yourself. Feel that coursing through you, the cosmos coursing. Thomas goes on, but we're not done yet. Where did the photon come from? We know that in the core of our sun, atomic fusion creates helium atoms out of hydrogen atoms, in the process releasing photons of sunlight. So, if photons come from hydrogen atoms, where did the hydrogen get the photons? This leads us to the edge of the primeval fireball, to the moment of creation itself. The primeval fireball was a vast gushing forth of light, first so powerful that it carried elementary particles about as if they were bits of bark on a tidal wave. But as the fireball continued to expand, the light calmed down until, hundreds of thousands of years later, the energy level decreased to a point where it could be captured by electrons and photons in the community of the hydrogen atom. Hydrogen atoms rage with energy from the fireball, symphonic storms of energy held together in communities extremely reluctant to give this energy up. But in the core of stars, hydrogen atoms are forced to release their energy in the form of photons. And this photonic shower from the beginning of time powers your thinking. So we're not only coming from the sun, says Suzanne, we're back at the beginning of time. Yay! Youth asks, really? Thomas, fires from the beginning of time empower you right now, this instant. What you are thinking and feeling this very moment is possible only through the cosmic fire. Your entire nervous system is rich in this fire. Youth, I'm speechless. Thomas, you're churning with new psychic energy, aren't you? Who has evoked this energy but the universe, our primary teacher? The universe lured us into 4 centuries of careful empirical investigation, and now, far from finding a pile of sterile data, we are stunned to be flooded with psychic energy. The universe bestows on us fire from the beginning of time, simultaneously evoking our profound reverence for this fire. The universe demands our response. Do we awake, dedicating ourselves to a vision of beauty worthy of our fire's origins? Do we shape this fire as it has shaped us, aware of the awesome work that has gone into providing it? As we lie in bed each morning, we awake to the fire that created all the stars. Our principal moral act is to cherish this fire, the source of our transformation, ourselves, our society, our species, and our planet. In each moment, we face this cosmic responsibility to shape and discharge this fire in a manner worthy of its numinous origins. We cherish it by developing conscience in our use of it. Are we tending this fire, revering it? Are we creating something beautiful for for our planetary home. This is the central fire of yourself, the central fire of the entire cosmos. It must not be wasted on trivialities or revenge, resentment or despair. We have the power to forge cosmic fire. What can compare with such a destiny? When I say the universe is the principal moral authority, I mean by this the manner in which we are taught the value of the earth. The elements were bestowed on us by the stars, the complex compounds given to us by the young earth, the informed sequences of the genes by the microorganisms, our limbs and organs by advanced life forms, and the linguistic symbols carrying our thoughts and feelings by the human venture. We could not see without the work of those who shape the eye. We could not hear without the work of those who shape the ear. The universe created these gifts, lavishing them upon us. Our first and deepest response is infinite gratitude. That which created all of this now desires our creativity, commitment, and labor, our delight in entering with full awareness the cosmic story. The mountains and oceans, stars and life forms, all recipients of the same generosity, contributors to the unknown future culminations of our work, all tremble with the same power. Given a finite number of days in which to live, a particular store of primordial fire with which to work, who could deny that all that matters is contributing to the awesome work of fashioning the universe? And that's why I condense our contemporary cosmological scientific story of reality by saying that the universe is a green dragon. Green because the whole universe is alive. An embryogenesis beginning with the cosmic egg of the primeval fireball and culminating in the present emergent reality. And a dragon, too, nothing less. Dragons are mystical, powerful, emerging out of mystery, disappearing in mystery, fierce, benign, known to teach humans the deepest reaches of wisdom. And dragons are filled with fire. Though there are no dragons, we are dragon fire. We are the creative, scintillating, searing, healing flame of the awesome and enchanting universe. Well, that's the end of this incredible book. Once again, I am filled with wonder, awe, appreciation. And here's Brian's appreciations at the end. I'll read you the acknowledgments. Not the specific ones to the people he names, but the generic one, where he says, what was essential? Air, the foods of the earth, rainfall, of course, and the awe of summer electric storms. But does it make any sense to list these? I think so. The stupendous silence of the mountains permeates my thinking. Shouldn't it be mentioned? Without the mystery of a forest at night, I should have dried up long ago, or the brooding that winter snows teach. My principal debt, though, is to the beauty of the night sky, and my thanksgiving is for human sentience and its exultant expression in our scientific, artistic, and religious traditions. Now, Brian went on from writing this wonderful book to producing a tape series of lectures he actually did in the classroom called Canticle to the Cosmos, where you can hear Brian, the original, non-intermediated by me, at his absolute beautiful best. I love that tape series. I urge you all to buy it. Here's the letter that Brian sent around when that series first came out, which is quite beautiful. I'm going to read to you now. Dear reader, all the people who've read his books, who got this wonderful letter, at key transition moments in human history, consciousness advances in spurts. In Athens, the foundations for Western civilization were laid. At the school, at Chartres Cathedral, the vision of the Middle Ages was given form. In the Florentine Academy, Renaissance humanism was brought forth. We are in the middle of another such spurt. Human creativity today gives birth to a new vision of reality, a new cosmology, one that will guide us out of the terrors of late 20th century. One of the crucial differences in this transition is the availability of access points for creative participation. To participate at Athens, one had to be there, wandering about the agora. If you lived elsewhere, you wouldn't even get news summaries of what was taking place. So too, with the birth of humanism, one had to be there in Florence where the great ideas were worked out. But in our time, with the invention of electronic information technologies, groups in widely separated locales can participate directly in the evocation of this new form of consciousness. The creation of a new planetary mythology is an organic process requiring the intelligent participation of millions of minds. My hope in producing this video series is to provide a gateway for people interested in bodying forth a new form of consciousness. Over the last 10 years, I have been fortunate enough to work with a number of cutting-edge thinkers, some of them true geniuses in this work. Canticle to the Cosmos synthesizes the ideas from these leading scientists and scholars, especially those working at that vibrant center where science and mythology meet. If we were attempting to create a new cosmology 100,000 years ago, we would meet in a cave at night and tell our stories in the flickering lights of the fire. In just such a setting, the most advanced hominid forms gave birth to the first true humans. I think there is something to be said for this tradition. My suggestion is that you gather as a group and reflect together in the night. If these flickering images and words evoke some of the deeply rooted creativity that is necessary for our advance, this series will have served its purpose. I love that image, says Suzanne. That's the end of his letter. He says, thank you very much, Brian Swin. That image of us gathering in the personal nature of things, which is what I hope you get a feel for, even though you're listening via an electronic mechanism. What my life is all about is this personal nature of things. My website invites you to communicate, be personal with me, and I will be personal back with you, and hopefully we'll grow a vast new personal world. Who knows how? I mean, obviously one person can't talk to everyone, or none of us can be in touch with everyone else, but somehow, as we build on a core of interpenetration, not as cogs in a machine, but as real beings touching each other's hearts, somehow we will build this new reality. That's the one that we so yearn for, and that will give life, not only life, but joy and celebration to us all. Now I'm going to add something from the manual, the study guide that goes along with Canticle to the Cosmos, and read to you from the very last part of this that sums it all up, because Brian goes further in Canticle to the Cosmos to tell his incredible story, do this incredible work that he does. Let's see if we can give you a little taste that will tempt you to go further and actually acquire this and become part of this personal story that's you, me, Brian, all of us. So I'm just going to read you a little bit from the ending of the Canticle for the Cosmos study guide. 4 million years ago, the climate got very dry and the trees began to shrivel up. The trees retreated. Suddenly the ape men were left there on their own on the savannas. The early humans would gather together and move about looking for food. The males would gather the meat, the females the vegetables. There was a differentiation of labor back then. For 4 million years, humans lived in groups of 25 to 40. It took a lot of room to support a tribe. They were in one place for about a month, hunting and gathering food. Once they had harvested an area, they moved on. Population control was very severe. Between 15% and 50% of all births ended in infanticide. There was the recognition that if all were allowed to live, their way of life would fall apart. Everything was day-to-day. There was no accumulation of goods because they had to carry everything. There was no hierarchy. Everyone had access to food. Everyone knew how to make the tools. There was no need to control anything. The common needs of the tribe predominated over the individual's need. There were ways of applying pressure. The most common was the blood feud. Another was scorn. To be scorned by the whole tribe was a very severe punishment. The final punishment was absolute banishment. Usually a person banished from a tribe would die. Not all conflicts were overcome. If you had a really deep conflict, you split off. That is why the tribes were around 25 to 40. Larger than that, the social complex was simply too much. Tribal societies are the only societies we know that had no games of strategy. The notion of planning was not part of their world. They were always in the magic of the moment. Their rituals were cosmic play. Some of the tribal peoples have no words to distinguish work and play. There are still examples of tribal groups that have more festivals and feasts than work. Primal humans lived in a world of interpenetrating presences. Everything was immediate and present. It was very much like a waking dream. The ones that were the most skilled at entering the dream world were the medicine people. Everything was numinous to the tribal way of life. Nature was not a habitat, it was a participant. Everything was present, everything was conscious, everything spoke. We were hunter-gatherers for 4 million years. Then suddenly we decided to settle down and domesticate. We decided to stop roaming. It is a transition that took thousands of years, but on a geological timescale, it is an overnight affair. Domestication is only 1/4 of 1% of our history. The movement out of the Paleolithic into the Neolithic is a poignant moment. It is a loss of beauty, but it is also a pursuit of a new kind of beauty. 20,000 years ago is a date when we could say the Neolithic begins. It is a decision to establish a relationship with certain kinds of animals and plants. Humans began to selectively choose and breed animals. In time, what was wild, free, and difficult becomes more passive, agreeable, and domesticated. We have long assumed that as soon as humans figured out how to plant seeds and tame animals, they rushed into it. But the hunter-gatherer bands didn't want to settle down. They wanted to move. It was the traditional way of life. The movement into village life would only happen under extreme pressure. The pressures were probably population and climatic stress. Wandering bands of 25 to 50 people have a very delicate balance within their world. As soon as cultivation is developed, the population surges. Suddenly, you didn't have to limit your family that much. There were groups of 150 and 200 in Europe. In the villages themselves, Jericho was 2,000, and Catalhuyuk was around 5,000. The movement into village life is a great jump in the complexity of social relationships. It was a time when women had much more power. Spirituality was tied up with the abundance that is provided by the earth, and the central symbol of society would be the goddess. The other move out of the Paleolithic into the Neolithic is the emphasis of the masculine mode. These were the herding societies, the ones that stayed with the animals. It was life on the move. You had to be tough. A different ethos was established, one oriented by a transcendent deity, a sky god. The Hebrews are an example of this type of society. Inevitably, the two societies clashed. The herders were living this tough life, and they came across villages where there was abundance. For the first time in human history, it became biologically intelligent to wage warfare. As long as there was no abundance, warfare was not an intelligent thing to do, so the herding societies overran the horticultural societies. Often they didn't leave. They would stay there. You had the meeting of a warring society and a more peaceful society. What resulted was a new kind of society. It is one where, for the first time, villages had fortifications. They had to protect their abundance from the herding peoples. We were in Australia 40,000 years ago. We were on this continent 30,000 years ago. What is interesting is that the earth is round. Eventually, no matter how far we roamed, we had to turn back on ourselves and meet again. If the earth were an infinitely flat place, we would continue to spread forever as hunters and gatherers. It is the nature of the earth that is fundamental to our having to deal with one another. The earth is round because of the nature of the gravitational interaction. I'm trying to bring the universe into the human story, as opposed to thinking of humans on a lone stage doing their thing. We are the way we are because of the curvature of space-time. When we entered into domestication, we developed a new species. As we move from the Neolithic into classical civilization, it is again a reinvention of the human. Humans discovered the erotic spots of the earth. They left behind one form of life and entered another. What are those hot spots? They are places where the earth would do most of the work for you. The alluvial floodplains, the river valleys. There are four places on the planet where classical civilization was invented. Tigris and Euphrates rivers, Nile River, Indus River, Yellow River. People came to the river valleys and discovered there was great advantage in growing crops. There was a fusion among people of different lineage and kinship. Suddenly you have 100,000 people that had to be organized. This is another moment when the universe complexified, where another emergence was possible. Something came forth that had the significance of a galaxy, of an atom. It was the state. The state is a centralized bureaucracy that oversees a particular territory, maintains a system of law, and is involved in the distribution of surplus. Once the state is created, there is another jump in surplus, and the population grows. Certain skills have to be learned for the first time. Humans specialize by focusing on particular tasks. There is a narrowing and a deepening. Competence is arrived at. Because of specialization, there is a greater dependency on the whole society for survival. There is a tremendous eruption of abundance and warfare. From here on, warfare is chronic. The need to protect a surplus is what eventuates in kingship. It resulted in another significant emergence within the human called stratification, the separation into classes of people. Aside from their need for protection, why did people allow themselves to be dominated by the economic elite, and in particular the king? It was in the king that humans experienced individuality. In the primal peoples and the village peoples, there wasn't such an intense awareness of individuality. With the king, suddenly there was the individual for the first time in history. The four civilizations had different religions, different histories, but these are true of all four. First was the king dominating as ruler. It was a commitment to chronic warfare, slavery, and racism. Second was the dominance by the economic elite. Between 1% and 2% of all the people owned 70% of the land. Third was the domination of women by men. Whether in the church, the state, or the economy, women were denied central roles of power and authority. Fourth was the dominance of the human over the natural world. In all cases, it was the use of the earth for the human. This sequence takes us up to the emergence of another kind of society, the one we are living in now. Conditions changed and we arrived at another time with new possibilities. It began with an awareness that we were living in a cage. The modern project can be defined as the decision to break out of the cages that humans found themselves within. There is a break over centuries that changes what it means to be human. The king is deposed. The power is taken away from the nobility. Suddenly we have the United States of America and France. We end an institution that had been the dominant one for 5,000 years, an awesome move. There was a breakout with the development of the scientific enterprise. We wanted a direct experience with truth. It wouldn't be taken from the church or the state. Likewise, there were revolutionary changes in the religious hierarchy. With the Reformation, there was a cry of individual salvation. Each person could have a direct relationship with God. Another move would be in economics. We wanted a free market rather than a command economy dictated by a king and the nobles. This began in England and went to America and France. Then South America, Russia, China, the entire world is remade. He calls this part the tragedy of the modern project. In a certain sense, we were breaking out of dominance relationships in the scientific technical period. The tragedy is this. Western society freed itself from the king and immediately set out colonies. We went out and roped all sorts of countries into our free market system. Even though it looks like we escaped from oppression, it is not clear at all that we have. We don't have the king, but we have an industrial society that oppresses the third world. We have an economic stratification that is just as severe as that of any kingdom. We have elite industrial countries in charge of the rest of the planet. Patriarchy has become more abusive through the growth of industrial society. Women have not been a part of the great establishments, the corporations, the military, the governments, the churches. The dominance of the human over the natural world has increased exponentially. It is what we train all of our technology on. I am trying to name why we are confused, why we are deluded in our present moment. And then this very last section in the study guide, he calls a new prosperity. In this section, he goes back to the universe as a green dragon, recapitulates it, and takes us further into the new possibilities. And you're going to have to get the Canticle to the Cosmos to hear this for yourself, read this for yourself. But I'll just give you a couple of tidbits from this very, very last section. It's headed up by the statement, "The main task of the immediate future is to assist in activating the intercommunion of all the living and non-living components of the Earth community in what can be considered the emerging ecozoic era of Earth development." And there are a couple of little italicized poetic phrases in this section, and we're going to end our visit around the campfire with my reading these to you. "When we see ourselves within the universe, we will have the strength to bear the destruction of the moment. Only the universe is large enough to bear the suffering of the earth." And so, as not to take you out on suffering, but on possibility, this last, very last poetic statement that Brian makes is, "In my own dream, our destiny is to become Homo ludens, the playing human. The universe is awaiting us to embrace our destiny." Meet you in the future, in the now, in the beauty, in the awe, in the celebration. That's Suzanne speaking to you, grateful to Brian. Thank you for listening. Visit me. Play with me. Let's make a new world together.
Thank you for listening to theconversation.org, making sense of these times. Now that you've heard from us, we'd love to hear from you. Click the feedback button on the show's webpage and share your thoughts. We'll be posting new shows approximately once a week. If you would like to be emailed when new shows are posted, let us know. This show is brought to you by MightyCompanions.org, dedicated to encouraging the awareness of ourselves as a one life, and providing a meeting ground for those who share that awareness.